Hey, it's Mike Halford from the Halford and Abruff podcast. First, thank you for downloading and listening. We really appreciate it. Two, enjoy whatever silliness is about to ensue. One on a Tuesday. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Halford Bruff, Sportsnet 650. Got a lot to get to in the final hour of this program. A reminder, if you want to listen to hours one and two, download the podcast. Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, we are available. Lots to break through from the first 2 hours of the program. So again, download, enjoy, rate, review, subscribe, smash that subscribe button. Can you do that? Is that a thing you can do? Right on. Halford and Bruff of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. Before we get to Drance, tell everybody about the food bank and all the emojis they can text.
Yeah, Canucks win yesterday. Everyone should be feeling more charitable. This Friday, December 10th, between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., in partnership with Boyd Auto Body and Glass, it's Food Bank Friday. It's easy to donate. You can text a carrot emoji to 30333. That will donate $5. Text a banana emoji to 30333 to donate $10.
I mean, it's one banana, Michael. What could it cost? $10?
You can text a red heart emoji, I will never get tired of that, to 30333 to donate $25. Cash donations can also be made online. Details at sportsnet.ca/650.
To the phone lines we go from the Athletic Vancouver and the Canucks Hour right here on Sportsnet 650. It is Thomas Drance. What up, Drancer?
Gentlemen, good morning.
We have so much to get into. Where do you want to start?
Let's ask him the poll question.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because the poll question is a good jumping off point. Okay. Who had the most impressive day yesterday? Bruce Boudreau, Thatcher Demko, or Stan Smeal?
I'm going to go with Stan Smeal.
Mm-hmm. Good answer.
I'm going to go with Stan Smeal because I think he did something that we haven't seen this organization do nearly enough of in an awful long time. And it wasn't just about what he told us at the press conference. It was also that he told the exact same line. He gave the exact same message to the players in the locker room earlier on in the day, right? So Monday morning, Stan Smeal and a bunch of Canucks management, like basically the entire interim committee that they've assembled with Stan Smeal as its chairman or interim GM to steer the ship for, you know, in the post-Benning era and until they hire a new general manager and or president of hockey operations, walks into the Canucks room and he delivered the finger-pointing line, right? And this was like a scathing bit of criticism. You know what I mean? Like Stan Smeal came out there and said, what happens when things start going badly is everyone starts pointing fingers at each other. Players point fingers at the coach at the GM, everyone at the owner, general manager at the coach. And like, we're not going to do that anymore. Like Stan Smeal basically just said, we have a losing culture, right? Like Stan Smeal went in and blasted the character of everyone in that room, basically, and had the stones and the authority and like the gruff gravitas to pull it off. And he did that in the room. And then he came out and he did it in the press. And he delivered the same message. And it was a harsh one. And how often do you think this team has had the exact same message in the room as they've then heard later on in the press? Like, how often do you think there's been that level of consistency in terms of how this team communicated?
Good point.
And more than that, how often do you think someone has been adult enough to just lay it on the table like that, harshly, like to really examine like that level of self-examination? You know, to me, gentlemen, that looks an awful lot, sounds an awful lot like actual leadership here. And boy, is that something this club needed. So for me, I think there's still a bunch of things that I'm nervous about in terms of this club's overall direction. Like, you know, there was a sort of gentle, polite fiction spun that, you know, Smeal, in fact, had an awful lot to do with the Boudreau hire. And there were a few things that I think still sort of piqued my ears that I thought like, oh boy, like, I don't know about that. Or that process seems, you know, awfully odd. Like I hate that this organization required their general manager and their head coach, whose leadership was so clearly untenable for weeks leading up to them being tarred and feathered in the town square on Saturday. Mm-hmm. It bothers me that all of that needed to happen, that this played out in that way. And yet, you know, when I hear and see someone go about asking the tough questions the way Smeal did, I think, you know, that's probably a pretty important first step for this club as they look to turn the page.
Okay, a bunch of questions we want to ask off of that. I guess one, and a texter sent this in way earlier. Did they just wait way too long to make all these moves?
Yeah, I mean, but it depends on an awful lot of things. Like, what do you mean? Like, did they wait too long to move on from Jim Benning, considering they finished last in the All-Canadian division?
No, I guess what I'm saying is that if you landed on this decision, after, like you said, after having things get as ugly as they did, and again, hindsight's 20/20, but could you not have done this full-scale thing 2-3 weeks ago, where you're not so far down in the standings and so much losing hasn't happened? If you've already kind of considered it, should you not have just made the proactive move and done it weeks ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think after that trip where you go through Colorado, Vegas, and Anaheim, you know, if your goal is still to make the playoffs, I think you have to make the coaching change there, right? Like, if you're because at that point, you know, if you win the three games at home that they came home to, they only won one. They only won the game against Winnipeg, and the crowd was already, like, at that point, you could tell that the moment the Canucks got into a lopsided game at home, they were done. Mm-hmm. And then that five-game road trip's the season, you lose those three games off the bat, even though they played well in Columbus and Pittsburgh. And that's basically it. Like, you're basically done. You know, I mean, this is a lost season now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, from a making the playoffs standpoint, yeah, you had to make it back then. And look, there are indications that the Canucks started sniffing around, like that permission was asked to talk to Claude Julien, like, you know, 3 weeks ago, more than 3 weeks ago. So, you know, they knew, they just didn't act. And there was a organizational paralysis of sorts that, you know, I also think needs to be examined in full. Because whether it was loyalty, whether it was a disagreement over, you know, whether like, and I do think this all played into it. I think there was a sense that, you know, fundamentally the team construction's at issue. So does the GM get to make the decision to fire another coach? Or, you know, should we fire the GM? But if we fire the GM, does that actually change the experience for the guys in the room? And, you know, there was some hemming and hawing, and it took a while for the club to chart a new course. And, you know, it did feel like a huge relief. And I think it felt like a huge relief. Like, at the end of the day, it doesn't feel like it was about Jim, and it doesn't feel like it, for me, it wasn't about Travis either. It was definitely about Bruce Boudreau, but it was more about just like, since January of 2021, this has been the big story in Vancouver. Like, we have speculated, and the team has speculated, players have speculated, like, management has wondered. The whole team has been waiting for a shoe to drop for 11 months in some capacity. And it finally happened, and it was like, okay, like, the axe has fallen. Like, we can kind of move on. Like, it just felt like a huge breath of fresh air. So, yeah, should something have happened an awful lot earlier? I don't think that's debatable.
Drance, what did you think about Francesco Aquilini pushing back on the notion that he was overly involved in hockey decisions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they pushed back on it, and then I immediately steered my next question right off the bat. They did the autonomy thing, and then I immediately just brought up the Boudreau process.
Right.
And that was the
we noticed. We noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was the play because, you know, and then, you know, well, after Stan recommended him, his agent called me and I negotiated a deal that worked for Boudreau and me, right? It's like, okay. So, you know, that's not super usual, right? Like, it's not super common in this game that you'd have the coach take the lead like that or the owner take the lead like that. Like, sometimes you'd involve the owner. You'd certainly involve the owner on approval for budget, but, you know, that level of hands-on recruitment negotiation, yeah, I mean, that is a little bit different. I don't know that was the most credible part of a press conference, in which otherwise I thought Francesco performed well. I thought he came across as, you know, actually relatively humble, relatively well-spoken. And more than that, he was available and accountable, and that matters. So, you know, I thought it was a decent day for him, but was that the strongest, most convincing moment of it? No.
We're speaking to Thomas Drantz from The Athletic Vancouver and Sportsnet 650 here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Drantzer, should Stan Smeal be considered, or should he be maybe even a leading candidate for the president of hockey ops role if the Canucks decide to create that position?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think it's something that he's ever really wanted. Like, I don't think it's something that, like, I think it's a step beyond his ambition. And I think it's, you know, not just a step beyond his ambition. Like, I don't think this is something that, you know, I don't think he's the guy necessarily to modernize this organization the way it needs. You know, like, I don't think he's the executive to create the next great era of Canucks hockey. He is, at the end of the day, like, this organization's most loyal and like, best soldier, right? Like, from his playing days on for 40 years, like, as a minor league coach, as a, you know, director of player personnel, as a guy who led their college recruiting efforts while they brought in guys like Stetcher and Tanev, Volpatti, and on. I mean, you know, he's got 40 years of service to the organization. He is a character guy through and through. You know, by all accounts, an intelligent administrator. I just don't think he's ever wanted this. Like, I don't think he's ever aspired to be at the top of Canucks hockey operations. So, you know, for me, I don't sort of see him as a long-term fit. I just see him as an impressive guy. And as a person who, you know, in this club's moment of need has stepped up and I think is a credible voice to do that in the interim. So, you know, I don't really see him as a full-time candidate. I'm sure he'll be considered if he wants it. I'm not sure he does. And so we'll sort of see where this goes. But I think this is more, you know, a guy stepping up to, and you could tell. I mean, you can tell when he talks how much this club, how much this franchise, how much basic respectability for the organization matters to Stan Smeal. I think that's what this is about. I don't think this is about, you know, like a the guy, the next general manager rises and shows his mettle. Like, I don't think that's the direction this will end up going in. Just because I don't think that's who Stan is or what he wants either.
Do you think it's imperative that they go outside the organization and find someone that doesn't have any previous ties to what's gone on to either be the president of hockey ops or general manager?
Yeah, I think they should. I mean, I think they absolutely should go outside the organization. You know, I do think that that's an important step for the club to take. You know, I think it's just so much that needs to happen in terms of what's next for this club. Like, I think they need a president of hockey operations too, right? I don't think bringing in a GM is sufficient. I think you need more bodies than that. I then think you need more bodies beyond that. You need a director of player personnel. You need, you know, I think you need three or four assistant general managers these days. Like, you need so much to have the type of big tent collaborative dynamic organization that can compete with the type of horsepower, and I mean horsepower in terms of like actual brain power, that you've got in, you know, some of these sharper hockey organizations, right? Whether it's Toronto or Tampa Bay or Carolina or, you know, even Columbus, New Jersey. So, you know, the club's got an awful long way to go. I think they need a really dynamic leader. I do think it would be helpful if that leader came from outside. You know, and had few existing ties to the organization, because there's just so much that's gone off the rails or gone wrong and needs to be set right. Yeah, I think you need a really dynamic personality and ideally from an external situation to come in and oversee that. That would certainly be, you know, what I'd be recommending and hoping for from the perspective of Canucks fans.
Drantzer, I want to get back to the issue of ownership and ownership involvement in hockey ops. A number of people are pushing back in the text inbox and saying, well, maybe the hiring of the coach was a special circumstance in that he was going to fire the general manager and the general manager's assistant. So who else but the owner could have made that decision? I don't want to get into the weeds too much on that, but I do think that hanging over all of this, regardless of who is hired to be the general manager or the president of hockey ops, or if they have a president of hockey ops, or they just go with the general manager, there is a notion, fair or not, right or wrong, whether Francesco Accolini likes it or not, that he is overly involved in hockey ops, that he's a meddler, that he will not give full control to whoever heads up the hockey ops department. And I'm wondering how they're supposed to get over that. Because I even think like not meddling or not being involved, you're still going to have that hanging over the organization.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what, like, I don't know. Why are people pushing back on this? I honestly am.
Well, they're pushing back at just the notion that hiring the coach proves that he's overly involved, because they could say that was a special circumstances because he didn't have a general manager because he fired the general manager.
Sure. Although, I mean, we all know, and it's been very well reported, that, you know, the level of involvement in ownership's hiring of, for example, John Tortorella during the last regime, right? So it's like two of the last four head coaches in this market have been, you know, directly tied to ownership as opposed to any executive. You know, we know during the pandemic, as the club went down to, you know, the bottom 10 in NHL payrolls for the first time in 8 years, that, you know, ownership's involvement in hockey operations decisions increased. I think it's pretty clear that the fall of 2020, that everything that unfolded after the team left the bubble in Edmonton until free agency opened and the club lost a ton of, you know, metal, a ton of key players and people, you know, that's like the moment where in my view anyway, the betting era really went off the rails. And I don't think this team was ever going to be great under Jim Benning's stewardship. I just think that, you know, his approach to management was too simple. Like they were always going to be bleeding some value, but there was enough momentum and direction, I thought, after the bubble that, hey, maybe this can work, at least to be a consistent playoff team or a team that's, you know, interesting for the next couple of years. And, you know, I think that went off the rails pretty significantly as a result of how the pandemic unfolded, how it impacted the club, you know, some key mistakes that were made, including an inability to buy out any contracts. You know, that wasn't approved. So, you know, I mean, I don't really know beyond that what to say. I think the industry-wide perception about ownership's involvement, is fair. Like, I think it's fair. And I think it would have been a good step, for example. You know, Francesco's asked about Mike Ford, for example, or bringing in an outside group to consult on the recruitment of the next executive, and sort of said, oh, it's too early in the process, we haven't really looked at that yet. But you know, all things are on the table. I mean, I think it would have been a really good step. Like, I think it would have been a really smart bit of PR to insulate Francesco Accolini from the search for the next general manager. And, you know, I think there's no question that would have been, you know, something that helped restore some confidence in this market. And look, I appreciate fans are pushing back again. That means fans have some hope again, right? But the reality is, I think that, you know, these concerns are valid. The market's concerns are valid. And they're, you know, shared by a wide swath of the industry and those that have observed this team function over the course of especially the last 8 years, but dating back even further than that too.
The way I've heard it put to me is that this ownership group, oftentimes when they'll hire someone new, they will give full control and they'll say, you know, I believe that you can help bring us out of this. So whatever you want to do, I support it. But then when cracks start showing, in the organization and big losses happen or losing season, missing the playoffs, that's when the ownership starts to kind of tighten its grip on things. So maybe, I don't know, what's needed is maybe a new leadership group that kind of wows the Aquilinis into thinking, okay, this group knows what it's doing, and then there's freedom. Because I think, is it fair to say that when the Gillis regime started, what Francesco Aquilini said yesterday, in that my job is to support the management, and if they want the resources, we'll give them the resources, that actually did happen?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was talking to a player agent a couple days ago, and they were talking about one thing that happened during the Gillis era is part of the pitch that you'd get from the Canucks, right, was that we've invested all this money in sports science and, you know, performance management and sleep doctors and on, that, you know, if your client comes here, if he comes here, he's going to make more money. We're not going to pay him more money. In fact, we're going to pay him less. He's going to have to take a little bit less, but we're going to extend his career because of what we've done, the money we've spent between the lines, like the money we've spent on having this edge over our opponents. And they were making this pitch in like 09, 08, when people thought it was hocus pocus. Right now, the industry's caught up and guys wear all sorts of, you know, sensors, and there's all sorts of data on performance, you know, chips and jerseys and practice and on and on. But they were spending a ton of money, investing a ton of resources into being ahead of the game and then actually articulating that, pitching that externally as they recruited players. You know, that was a decade ago. I think part of what this organization needs to get back to doing is investing resources in those edges, like in places that are outside the roster, but that have a huge ROI. And I think that's been something that the club's gotten away from, right? The club is mostly spent to the cap and beyond, honestly, like beyond the cap in terms of actual salary expenditure. They've been probably the third or fourth highest spending team in terms of lump sum payments, like signing bonuses. Those are big payments. Like, that's a big commitment from ownership group, you know, from the ownership group. You cannot suggest that Canucks ownership's not committed. But I do think part of what they've got to do is go back to spending money and investing in things that are maybe, you know, like not a third pairing defenseman, but in fact are, you know, in innovation and in things that can give you a tangible edge. The types of edges that add up by making sure that you create an environment where everyone's at their best. So, you know, yeah, I think they do need a leader who's given a high degree of authority. I do think they're going to need someone who's given a lot of autonomy. And I do think that, you know, part of what they need, right? Because while it's fair to say, in my view, it's fair to say that, you know, ownership has been very involved in Canucks hockey operations over the last 5 years, especially. You know, I think part of that responsibility, too, falls on management to manage up. You know, I think that was something that sort of fell by the wayside and particularly sort of became difficult when the budget crunch of the pandemic hit, right? For this organization, all told. And so, you know, I think partly it's on getting back to building a world-class organization and maintaining a world-class organization, but also partly it's on finding and building a structure where management is more effective at managing up on ownership too. So, you know, a long-winded answer to say that it is a double-edged sword and it is complicated, especially because ownership's always going to have some role to play, like an important role to play in terms of that level of support, right? And in terms of, you know, budget oversight and approval, because at the end of the day, this is their team.
We're going to go long here because we want to get to the on ice as well. Bruce Boudreau's first game in charge yesterday, 4-0 win over the Los Angeles Kings. What was your big takeaway from either a philosophical change, a strategic change, a deployment change that you saw last night, the one big takeaway if you had to choose one?
I mean, I just thought it was a breath of fresh air. Honestly, I just thought it was a breath of fresh air. You know, people, there was certainly a big change on the PK. I think 8 different Canucks penalty killers got ice time. And that to me is probably very much just like a big picture play. Like, hey guys, we're not going to leave this and hang this around the necks of 4 guys anymore. Like, we're all going to pitch in and see if we can turn this around. Obviously, there was a bit more aggression, not even a bit more aggression, a lot more aggression in terms of how they approached the 4-on-5 play. Bruce Boudreau sort of suggesting that they might have caught the LA Kings unaware. They might have caught them by surprise by sort of debuting something that new yesterday. So, I mean, we'll see how it lasts. I still think this club's penalty killing personnel and overall defensive intelligence are going to be an issue. You know, small tweaks to the aggression of the forecheck. I thought, generally speaking, players used width a little bit better and with a little bit more discipline on entries, especially as they transition the puck. But that to me is probably not systems so much as it's just, you know, guys being at their best, guys being relieved, guys trying to make a good impression on a new head coach. So, you know, for me, like, we can talk about the fourth line got more ice time, or, you know, the young players played more early. The PK had 8 forwards log ice time on it. I mean, there was tweaks, right? There were definitely things that looked different than what we've seen. But I just think the biggest difference was that, you know, what had happened, what the organization had spent weeks and months wincing in anticipation of, it happened. And it felt like players were unencumbered, were free, weren't playing scared anymore. And I think that was the same as the vibe at Rogers Arena, as you saw fans really bring it and have a good night out, like an uncomplicated, joyous night out at the rink, something that we probably haven't seen since before the pandemic.
Drancer, great stuff today, bud. Thanks a lot for doing this. We appreciate it. Enjoy the show today with Jamie Dodd. Reminder, Canucks Hour goes from 11 till 12 here on Sportsnet 650. We'll do this again next week.
Thanks, boys. Be well.
YouTube, thanks. Thomas Drance from The Athletic Vancouver and the Canucks Hour here on Sportsnet 650. Dom has an announcement he needs to make. Dun, dun, dun. Regarding podcasts.
I'm terribly sorry to those who are looking for hour 2 and eventually hour 3. Looks like we have some issues on the back end, and we are trying to get through them as quickly as we can.
So the podcasts are pending. Hour 1 still available for download. A reminder, Apple, Google, Spotify. If you're on Apple, drop a review, won't you? Make it a 5-star rating. Someone dropped the 4-star the other day and said they consciously did it because I asked for a 5-star. They wanted to screw with me.
One of those people that does not respect authority. The authority of Halford and Brough. That's 5 right. Stars.
You will listen and you will rate accordingly.
You know, we hunted that person down.
It's true. Hey, you dance with the devil.
Yeah.
It's your own fault. Okay, we got what we
learned. Framed him for murder.
A little
heavy-handed, some people say.
Yeah, it was a bit of an overreaction, but, you know. It's Ask Us Anything. No, it's not. We're going to do What We Learns coming up on the Halford and Brough Show. That's next. Text in to the Dunbar Lumber text line at 650-650. What did you learn over the last 24 hours in sports? We have not mentioned once, that the New England Patriots won a football game yesterday throwing 3 passes. Three passes. That's not even 1 pass per quarter.
Shouldn't the Bills be embarrassed about that?
Ooh, we might have some audio on that front as well. Anything you guys want to get into, be it Canucks or the general world of Sprots, let us know. Dunbar Lumber text line 650-650. What did you learn over the last 24 hours in sports? Let us know. It's your chance to be on the radio. Halford, Brough, Sportsnet, 650. Halford and Brough of the morning, the final hour of this program. What We Learns, all that good stuff. Brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. I've said it a few times. I'll say it again. It doesn't matter where you bought your Acura. You can bring it to North Shore Acura, Acura of Langley, or Burrard Acura on Terminal Avenue and get it serviced. They want to amplify the fantastic craftsmanship and customer service they have at all 3 of the dealerships. So go give them a try. We're already into the month of December. It's going to be some tough weather out there. Your vehicle might need a tune-up. You might need new tires. Whatever. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today.
The official financial sponsor of Halford & Brough is ZLC Financial. It's your one-stop solution for all your financial and retirement needs in Vancouver. To learn more, visit ZLC.net. And remember, advice is only as good as the person you ask.
I'll do a what we learned, and I will start by a brief venture outside of the National Hockey League and the Vancouver Canucks. Monday Night Football, my lock of the week came through. The New England Patriots, in one of the more bizarre games you'll ever see, played at that level, with that magnitude, between two teams with that much on the line. The New England Patriots won 14-10 and threw the football three times last night. Once, twice, thrice. Three times. The fewest ever in franchise history. The two completions, so good on Mac Jones for completing two of the three passes. The fewest ever since the Bills did it way back in 1974. So the Patriots, you didn't watch the game. I was briefing you earlier.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of it
here
and there, but I was mostly focused on the hockey game.
Right. I got two TVs set up. Don't want to brag, but
No big deal.
Not a big deal, but it's a big deal. it was wild to watch because it was like you were watching something unfold and you knew what was going to happen next.
Was it like the Army-Navy game, which is coming up, by the way?
Yeah, kind of. It was. But the more intriguing thing was that everybody knew what was coming next. Like, the Patriots made no bones about what they were going to do. Like, they lined up in this gigantic bunch formation. I'm like, I think they might run it again. And the Bills knew what
the
they were going to do.
The I formation.
They had, like, three fullbacks, an extra, like, lineman that moved into the backfield.
And here come the four horsemen.
Everything was a jumbo package, practically. And they just kept running the ball. And the Bills knew this as well. Bills were like, at a certain point, they were like, wait a minute, Mac Jones has only thrown the ball once so far, and then went on to throw it two more times after that. But they just couldn't stop it. And it wasn't as though the Patriots were getting huge chunks of yardage, like 8 or 10 yards every run. I think three of their runs contributed for almost half of the yardage, and then they just kind of kept getting 3 yards in a cloud of dust. It was very methodical.
Was it demoralizing for the Bills?
Well, that was the question that was asked afterwards, but they didn't use the words demoralizing. I believe it was Jerry Sullivan, who is a Bills television reporter, WBIV or something like that. He went the full nine and asked, who's it, Micah Hyde and Jordan Poyer.
Poyer, yeah.
He doesn't play for the Montreal Canadiens. It's Jordan Poyer, okay? He asked him if they were flat out embarrassed. And
granted, this also came a week after, or shortly after, Jonathan Taylor
ripped them apart.
Sure,
but he didn't ask it like that. Okay. He asked if that Monday night performance was embarrassing. Yeah, let's just run the whole thing because they were not happy with the line of questioning.
Over 40 years since a team has won a game running that two times in a game, he's passing that three times. Is that embarrassing?
I mean, what kind of question?
Boy, what are we doing, bro?
What kind of question is that?
Criticizing you.
All right. I think we keep 7 points.
Yeah.
14 to 10.
Is that the final score?
We made stops when we had to. They had one big run. I mean, they got good backs. They kept coming back to a couple runs. I mean, I don't know how you want us to answer that question.
That's funny. We'll remember that.
It didn't stop there. I guess Hyde, on his way out, had a rant about respect and the lack of respect and everything. I will say, embarrassing isn't the right way to phrase that question. You need to ask what happened, either schematically or strategically, or did you guys just get your asses kicked in the trenches? Because that was what New England wanted to prove last night. That they were bigger and tougher and stronger and more physical, and that they could do that. They could bully you at the line of scrimmage. Because the ones that were killing the Bills was that they couldn't get off the field.
Are the Patriots this is going to be a deep reach? I don't want to really say that, but it's a deep reach.
They did it.
Trademark.
You did it.
Are the Patriots the 1990 Edmonton Oilers? They traded Gretzky after winning the Cup in 1988.
Okay.
They didn't win the Cup the next season. In fact, they were eliminated by Gretzky and the Kings. Flames won the Cup that year.
Okay.
But then they came back in 1990 and won the Stanley Cup again without
Wayne
Gretzky.
The only thing that hurts the analogy or comparison is that I don't think the Oilers ever reached the depths that the Patriots did in that 1 year where they had they were out of the playoffs. They were 7-9.
Sure.
And it was the Cam Newton.
But I think a lot of people didn't see them as Stanley Cup contenders anymore.
No, that analogy, that part of it works.
Yeah.
But I mean, the Patriots, it's such a weird trajectory because they went really down.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they drafted Mac Jones and were able to get to 15th in the draft because of that 7-9 record, no one expected the sharp upturn. Like, did anyone expect this? They were 2-4
to start the year.
They were 2-4 to start the year. Like, they've won 7 straight. And last night they did it by taking the ball out of Jones's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like, almost entirely.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic job of coaching. I know Sean McDermott was trying to downplay how badly he got outcoached by Bill Belichick. He said it was about Buffalo not capitalizing on their red zone chances and everything. But, you know, a lot of people said, well, by acknowledging that Belichick took advantage of fewer opportunities and you missed by having more opportunities, you're kind of acknowledging you did get outcoached a little bit. And it's gut check time for the Bills because this was supposed to be the year that they would take that next step.
Mm-hmm.
That step where maybe they get over the hump in the AFC Championship and beat the Chiefs. Now, I think mentally the ghosts are, oh my God, we're second in the division again,
again.
To New England. And we were only top of the table for 1 year.
Yeah.
And we just had a big
Monday Nighter at home in classic Buffalo weather and we lost it. Give me a moo cow on that because I want to get to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Listeners have been absolutely great today with a lot of their texts. Very thoughtful texts, funny texts like this one from Jason in South Van. What we learned, Tag Team is sending a royalties invoice to Canucks Sports Entertainment this morning. Hashtag Bruce, there it is. That was pretty funny.
That was good.
I was actually trying to figure out, like, what are they chanting? And then I had to search it on Twitter. Bruce, there it is.
When you searched it up, did you find the origins of it?
I think it was the Larscheiders that were there.
No, but was this in Minnesota or Anaheim or Washington? I have no idea. Maybe they played it last night. Is this Vancouver exclusive? Did you guys plan this out ahead of time? Because, I mean, it's a pretty clever tie-in to Jock Jams. Like, someone on Twitter yesterday said, is Bruce Boudreau the human Jock Jam? To which I said, maybe. But anyway, I need the background story. So text in 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line.
Okay.
Did this exist before?
Okay, don't talk too much. I'm going to try and get through some of these what we learned,
all right?
Okay. What we learned on signed text, it's amazing to see what a momentum-gaining penalty kill looks like. Yeah. Not only did the Canucks kill penalties last night, they looked dangerous offensively on it. That's what an aggressive penalty kill will get you.
That's what your top offensive players on the penalty kill will get you.
And I've always pushed back on the notion that you know, people have said, like, you don't want to put your top penalties out there because they might get hurt. Well, you know, Datsyuk had some success, and he was a penalty killer. Mm-hmm. We hate to admit it, but Bergeron and Marchand have had some success, and they've killed penalties.
But the funny thing is you've talked about this before. You're like, I'm worried about the penalty kill because they don't have the right personnel. And you can't the narrative of you can't afford to lose Mott and Sutter. I think last night, I mean, they did run 8 guys out there. That's a lot, right? They had 8 different guys killing penalties. So it's like, is that your philosophy now that this is going to be less about the specialists and more about everyone's getting a shot?
You just need smart players, too.
Like Boudreau said he turned to Brock Besser and was like, you're going to be the next one killing penalties.
And he's going to be like, you'll regret that.
That was a bad decision, Bruce. But it's out there, so it'll be interesting to see if that carries forward. Again, 1 game, very small sample size.
What we learned, another unsigned, Bruce Boudreau is giving me major Ted Lasso vibes. It wouldn't surprise me if he hung a Believe poster in the dressing room and made the players touch the poster before the game. Isn't it interesting that the Whitecaps went to a Ted Lasso type in Vanni Sartini, and now the Canucks have gone to, let's call it just a player-friendly coach.
Sure.
In Bruce Boudreau. Early returns are promising for the Canucks, but again, it is very early.
Yeah.
The next game, it could easily happen that the Canucks penalty kill is all fired up and aggressive and looking to make plays, and then the Bruins pick it apart because they are overly aggressive and they open up passing lanes and they open up shooting lanes. So let's enjoy yesterday. Let's enjoy yesterday. Let's enjoy the renewed energy and the renewed enthusiasm, but also keep an open mind on this. Mike, the urologist from Brockville, what we learned. Bruce Boudreaux gives fist bumps himself to every player post-game. He's like a coach that's also a Care Bear.
Look, this was part of the reason that you brought in Boudreaux specifically. It wasn't, like, again, everyone made the, several people have made the argument this morning. You could have slapped the interim tag on Bradshaw, two words, Bradshaw, and let him been the guy for X amount of time. But there's a certain thing, quality that you get with Boudreaux, and a lot of it is throw the arm around the guys, make them feel good about themselves, build them back up.
Yeah.
All those sorts of things.
They've been torn down enough.
Yeah.
It wasn't like someone had to come in and do the tearing down. The tearing down had already been done by all the losing.
On that note, by the way,
yeah,
Boudreaux is a combination of cheer bear, friend bear, funshine bear, good luck bear, and when needed, grumpy bear.
I'm not all familiar. I'm
neither
not
was
all
I.
That
I had to Google these.
With the Care Bears.
I'm an intensive Care Bear.
Who was that one?
It's from The Simpsons.
An intensive Care Bear.
It's from one of the Halloween episodes.
Matt and Ladner, what we learned, it was all Travis's fault, clearly.
Oh.
Jim Benning, yeah!
Signed, Jim B. Here we got one here, just came in. Hashtag WW, what we learned. The LA Kings are really, really bad. They did not look good last night.
That reminds me.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought this up, because Edler
really
now
bad?
Plays for them.
I don't think they're really bad.
They just beat the Oilers.
Yeah.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I just wanted to read it because I wanted to bring up the Kings side of things. Thank you for bringing up Edler.
Yeah. What about that reception? I thought it was kind of muted.
I think given the circumstances, it was understandable.
Okay.
They just had one of the biggest, most fundamental shifts in franchise history. I mean, I kept bringing that up. This is only the second time in franchise history that they've gone and gotten rid of a general manager and a head coach. It's a profound change. We're talking 50 years, 50 plus years of existence. This is a seminal moment. It just sucked that Edler had to come back right in the middle of that. Everyone that was there last night was there for one reason. That was to see how the team was going to play under Boudreaux and what the changes were going to be. The Edler thing was just unfortunate timing.
I
feel bad, but it was unavoidable.
That's the narrative around Edler, it seems like, in his leaving and how Jim Benning handled that. And now his return, it just feels like unfortunate timing.
You know who probably was the most thrilled about everything that happened last
Alex
night?
Edler.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike, the grad student, what we learned, not sure if you've read Brian Burke's book, but he made the decision that his teams would play exciting hockey, not the trap. And if last night is any hint of what's to come, I'll gladly take exciting up-tempo hockey with the odd blunder. It's like, whatever, the rankings. Okay. Number one, you want to play exciting up-tempo hockey and win. Number two is you'll play any style of hockey as long as you win. Number three is exciting up-tempo hockey and you lose. And number four is boring, dull, and you're still losing.
Yep.
That's kind of how it goes, right?
Power rankings.
Like, I think Canucks fans would accept trap it up, boring hockey if it led to a Stanley Cup. Don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, talk to New Jersey Devils fans from the 90s. Wish, for example.
Right.
He only looks back on those times with fondness. He's one of the few, but he looks back on it like those were great teams, and he loved it. I hate throwing the caveat out there all the time, but I feel like it's necessary just so people don't misconstrue what we're saying. We're cognizant of the fact that it was one game, and we know how the NHL works, that you get that.
But we'll take anything at this point.
But it gives you... Just the changes that we saw and that we've analyzed, it gives you some optimism that things are going to be different moving forward and that it won't just be a one-game thing.
Change is invigorating in itself. Like today at the Rogers Arena offices are not like every other day there.
Right.
And I would imagine that it got to be like every other day there for a while and it was a drag.
But you
have to take advantage of that energy and you have to turn that into momentum.
So perfectly lead into what I wanted to say here. That game against Wednesday on Boston, that's an intriguing game now, given what you've got going into it. I mean, think about how things have changed in a week. Had Marchand not done Marchand things, had the Canucks not fired Green and Benning and brought in Boudreaux, it would have been maybe just another step in the death march. But now, you've got a lot of really compelling storylines going into Wednesday night. And I threw it out earlier. You've got to think that with the renewed energy and trying to impress the new coach, wearing a bow tie on the bench, and you've got the looming specter of what Brad Marchand did to Oliver Ekman-Larsson, the recipe is there for some chaos on Wednesday night. I'm looking forward to it, to be perfectly honest. That game against Wednesday on Boston.
You know, they're taking on the Adams family.
Yeah. Wow. Wednesday's been playing well. That's a good hockey team over there.
Sheffield Wednesday?
Sheffield Wednesday. I must have been thinking of Sheffield Wednesday.
Do you know that's the only team that I've seen play in Premier League action?
Sheffield Wednesday?
I went to an Arsenal game at their old grounds at Highbury a long time ago, and they were playing Sheffield Wednesday. And some of the chants you hear, like, it's just so odd, like, Arsenal wasn't playing very well to start the game. They ended up winning in the end, but they weren't playing very well. So you had, like, these English guys going, like, come on, guys, it's only Wednesday. Okay, I'm like, that's a day of the week.
We got to get out of here. We will be back tomorrow. Signing off, I have been Mike Alford. He's been Jason Brough. He's been
It were Thursday.
Sheffield Thursday. And he's been Laddie. This has been the Alford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. That game against Wednesday on Boston –